with Career Admiral Desmond Pierce in Chester. Like our first report, we're looking out over the Atlantic, and it's a nice sunny day, and this is the place where we both should be. Thank you, Debbie, for agreeing to for a further interview. And in view of what we've been saying, I'll start with what I've just said to you. We've been criticized because we didn't really catch on, get the hang of things until about 1943, and as Mark Milner points out, how could it be otherwise? We had a lot of men coming in, we had a lot of ships coming down. Jimmy Hibbard was pointing out we didn't get enough training. The RN had better equipment than ours, not quite naturally. They fitted their own ships first. We didn't have HFDF, we didn't have a good radar. And I had just said that when you said, what did you say a moment ago?
My situation with my own ship at that time was that I had a fairly good
ship. Just don't name the ship for the table.
Aboard the good old Restigouche, the Rusty Gutch. I'd been aboard that ship since before the war. It was 6 months off to be XO the Assiniboine and came back in command of the Restigouche. Our equipment was always way behind that of the Royal Navy. Now, there were many reasons for this. One is we were commissioning new ships at a very fast pace in those days. The corvettes were coming down the river in large numbers with green crews. We were lucky in destroyers to have a fairly experienced bunch of officers and indeed chiefs and petty officers. It wasn't as bad for us as it was for the corvettes. But we could not get new equipment until something very drastic happened to our ship. Now, my bad luck, good luck was that I nearly lost the ship in a storm. The Restigouche nearly sank. We survived it, and because of that survival, it took 3 months to fix the ship in the UK. I was able, through my own efforts, to get HFDF, and I was the first Canadian ship so to be fitted. It made a tremendous difference in what Restigouche could do thereafter. It was later than that I was able to get decent radar. And the other thing I want to stress is, with our great expansion and the brutal North Atlantic weather, we were always losing ships out of our groups, and other green ships were joining. And we, as Canadians, were based in St. John's, Newfoundland. We went across. Our Royal Navy pals had the fun of getting to their home port when they got back to Londonderry. For us, it was a port away from home. We had no liaison officer in Londonderry at that time. We had to take our turn after the Royal Navy ships and getting any kind of equipment. And we were always behind the eight ball. Another aspect of it was, why didn't we sink more submarines? Why didn't Restigouche sink more submarines? Our problem was that we were escorting the convoy, and our duty was the safe and timely arrival of the convoy. The Brits, very early on in the conflict, had U-boat, anti-U-boat aces like Captain Walker and others, and they formed hunter-killer groups. And we would go along with our convoys and do our best to fight off the U-boats. We could not afford the luxury of staying behind, hunting those few contacts that we might have made to exhaustion and killing U-boats. We had to stay with the convoy. One destroyer was all we could ever have, my old Rusty Guts. And we would have four or five corvettes. We would have to stay with the convoy. Having put the U-boat down, we would press on and hope that we could keep ahead of it. We would report where the submarines were, and frequently our hunter-killer groups from the Royal Navy would come along and pick up our wounded birds and make kills. And then that was another reason why we could never score as highly.
The other reason you couldn't stay long away from the convoy was you had the best ops room of all the warships, and you had to be back there to direct other people where to hide.
Exactly. With one destroyer, with the group only, you had to be in close contact. And once I got the HFDF, it had made a tremendous difference. It meant that every time a U-boat came to the surface and reported the position of a convoy, my PO tells Snaky Ellis, God bless his soul, was right dead on the bearing. He'd say, little E-bar signal bearing so-and-so. I'd immediately go on to full speed, turn the ship onto that direction, zigzag out, of course, always very cautiously, carefully, but going like a bat out of hell, go 4 or 5 miles off and drop depth charges at random. Now, in the convoy where I got my comeuppance, SC-107, where we lost 15 ships out of 45, if it hadn't been for the HFDF that I had, we would have been decimated. I didn't realize at the time how well we did with that convoy. We were naturally very seriously criticized for losing 15 ships and not having any known U-boat sinkings. But the Germans did a study of this post-war, as you know, Dr. Rover, and they did a study because they didn't see why every ship should not have been sunk in that convoy. And they thought that we had a super radar, that every time a U-boat came up and put up a periscope or put up an aerial to make a message, the course and speed of the convoy position, there'd be a destroyer running down at them and dropping depth charges. That was the rest of it. Only one ship, and I couldn't afford any time except to go and drop one pattern and then, as you say, get back to the convoy and take charge again.
An unfair criticism, I thought, the RN made was that the captain, I guess they were talking about you, was so junior. Well, you were only 25 or something, and yes, you were junior, but what's that got to do with it? You had been trained properly all the way up from cadet at RMC to cadet RCN up to Lieutenant Commander RCN. They didn't think that groups should be in such junior, commanded by such junior escort.
Yes, I read that, of course, in the report of SC-107. They were very kind to me in many ways. I said this young officer who had insurmountable circumstances against him, but perhaps a more senior commander might have done a little better. That could be. But,
well, I can't think of what... when I read the bloody thing, what could you have done? What could anybody have done better? Except with that escort.
Well, in the postmortems held on that convoy, the one done by Dr. Rover and another one done by Captain Waters, we didn't do too badly at all. It was rather nice 20 years later to find, or 30 years later to find out that you had done better than the enemy expected anyway.
Yeah, well, that answers that one.
But I do stress this business of we were always with the convoy with not enough escorts, with not a sufficiently coordinated group because there were changes made every time we came into port. We had to protect the convoy, hopefully put the U-boats down, and then turn our contacts over to the glory boys in the hunter-killer groups, who of course were superbly good at it, and they could wait for 24 hours and hunt this U-boat to exhaustion.
They hunted them for longer than that, didn't they?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Mm. So, well, fine. I'm going to change subject abruptly.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Now, morale in Restigouche was very high. I know that. I've talked to other people in her. I know you, for instance, were great on getting your daily newspaper out and keeping the troops informed, all the good things that you were taught in the RN. And I've just said recently, you were properly trained. At one time, you were... as a midshipman, you were guarding the crowned heads of Europe around the Royal Yacht, one midshipman. Now, there's responsibility at early
it
age.
Sure is.
they have the whole of MI5 and 6, and the Royal Marine Command is out there today. But you left as a cadet, and it was nearly 5 years before you got back later as a confirmed sub-lieutenant. And since, after the event, people have said that's too long for a young officer in his formative years to be away from his mother Navy, and maybe somehow they should have brought him back. This is all hindsight, but they say a lot of these officers came back. Well, Bobby Murdoch is the funniest one on this. He said, oh, they're quite right criticizing us. I came home and called my mother Mater, and she... she didn't know who I was talking to, and then all the kids in our block beat the hell out of me, and I resumed my Canadian accent. But anyway, the point is that at the formative years, you were away for 5 years from cadet to confirmed sub-lieutenant, and that the differences between the wardroom and the lower deck in the RN are different from the differences between the wardroom and the lower deck in the RCN, and that you officers that have spent your formative years in the RN didn't appreciate this difference when you first came back, and this is a private opinion, and not for, nothing's for being repeated, but I think poor old Jeffrey Brock is the worst example of that. Private opinion. But, what do you think about going away for 5 years in those years, and do you think there was this that you returning people didn't appreciate the difference between the RCN wardroom and the RCN lower deck.
No, I couldn't go along with that in any way whatsoever. I went away for 5 years because that was the system, and I did it, and I had my training, and I held my end up as a young Canadian with this whole mass of hundreds of Royal Navy boys, and did reasonably well with it. Ended up as chief cadet captain at the end of my first few months, and things like that. So Canadians were never at any disadvantage when serving with the Royal Navy. Now, did we learn any bad custom? I don't think so. We were taught how to be young officers, how to work with the lower deck. We Canadians perhaps had a little more liberal view of that than some of our RN fellows, but in all my 5 years of training, I never, ever came across any difficulties between the officers and the ratings in the Royal Navy. We were taught very much so to look after our men and know their names and watch them and encourage them and help them when they weren't doing well and encourage them to take courses, that sort of thing. Now, when I came back as a young lieutenant into the Royal Canadian Navy after my 5 years of training, there was no difference aboard ship. We had the wardroom, we had the sailors, and we got along wonderfully well together. I did not have any British accents. Some of the fellows might have. I had no tremendous deep feelings that I was trained in Britain. I was better than anybody else. This is a lot of bloody nonsense, and I've heard it expressed only just recently by our old pal Louis Odette, who was with me, one of my captains, and a lot of my convoys. And he, of course, was on the Mingy report, and he said all the difficulties, the incidents that we had were caused by bloody bad management of the officers, because we didn't want Canada badges because we wanted to be considered as Brits. Well, what bloody nonsense. I'm astonished that Louis could think that. However,
he said it is not true.
He had a lot of evidence, of course, from people who the lower deck who were trying to make an excuse for these incidents and were told that what they said to the Mingy Report members would never be printed. And Louis seemed to have some messianic desire that this should be recorded, and you know what the history of that. But that was absolute nonsense. I was aware that early on in the war, with so many reserves joining up on a permanent basis, I wore straight stripes of the Royal Canadian Navy. And we had that expression, a flaming straight striper. We were in the minority, of course, and we were the people who had some experience. But never in my whole experience of the war did I have any personal feeling that my training in the Royal Navy was anything but the best that you could possibly get. And there was never any, I felt, feeling of animosity against me as a person because I'd done my training in the Royal Navy. I just honestly don't think that was
You brought up another good point, though. You see, those mutinies, in my opinion, were caused by people like myself. RCNVR, I came in as a midshipman because I was 18. If I had been 21, I would have come in as a sub. If I had been 25, I would have come in as a lieutenant, right off the beach. Now let's take a hypothetical 25-year-old that came in off the beach. He did his courses, he went to sea in corvettes. His technical courses were what? 2 weeks at the gunnery school, torpedo school, signal school, and seamanship school, if that, and he went to sea. This hypothetical lieutenant is feeling pretty bloody salty after 3 years of this. He's probably screwed up a lot of attacks because he didn't know enough to sink the submarine, but he's feeling pretty salty, and his cap badge is green, and he then got a command. He probably made first lieutenant. He might have been first lieutenant on his first trip to sea. I had one in Moose Jaw with Freddie Grubb, first trip to sea, a tobacco salesman, in the Navy, 6 weeks. So now he's got a command course, and he takes command, and now, by God, he is an expert. He's had command of one of Her Majesty's warships at sea, and he still hasn't done any technical courses, and if the officers don't really know, Mickey Sterling said to me, Bob Welland said to me, Bob Welland's a better, he said, God damn it, this so-and-so, this officer we're talking about, He said he didn't know anything. He came in from the RCNVR and he started shooting up in rank. He said, but he didn't really know how anything worked. And he never took any technical courses. The sailors sense this. If a guy, then if this man has an unpleasant habit of domineering and being unreasonable and a bit shirty, this doesn't go down very well with the sailors in his mess decks that probably went to the same high school with him. If they couldn't join the same yacht squad and they went to the same high school with him. And I think the troubles originated from that. Inexperienced officers who were overbearing to their troops. When I finished the Jimmy Hibbert came down from Ottawa and he said, we're going to start a junior officer's technical leadership course because you guys don't know anything and you've got to do the equivalent of subs courses. Lawrence, of course, who didn't learn for many years, said, sir, that's very interesting and we would certainly look forward to it. Tell me, that's because we're transferring the reserves, and Jimmy Hibbert said yes. I said, tell me, are you going to start a senior officer's technical course? There was a ghastly silence because there were commanders, RCNVR, transferring to the RCN. But when I finished my JOTLC, I wondered how I'd got along in all those years without it. So that, I think, was part of the main cause of the mutinies in the Royal Canadian Navy. Now, what were your feelings about the RCNVRs like that? You had the good ones like Dun Lanche and the pre-war chaps like Gus Bolton. They knew their way around, but there were a lot that didn't. What did you feel about those RCNVRs?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say something about mutinies. We had a series of incidents in our ships which are technically, I suppose, termed mutinies. Now, I was aboard the Maggie in 1948 down in the Caribbean, and we were working very, very hard and on flying operations, etc. And I can remember telling Gus Miles one day, our captain, there had been other incidents, and I said, as far as the Maggie's concerned, I think we're okay. We've got a hell of a good crew. The only group I'm not sure of are the air group, because they come aboard and they go ashore and they come aboard and they go ashore. We don't really have a chance to know them. And a few weeks later, by gosh, the air crew were working so hard one morning they didn't want to turn out at 8 o'clock. Well, technically, if a bugle blows and you say hands fall in and they don't fall in, that's a mutiny. Well, sure enough, we had one. And I always thought that was a very harsh interpretation to put upon it. We had no trouble 15 minutes later getting them all to come up and get on with the work. But the fact that they didn't obey the bugle meant that we had a mutiny, a so-called mutiny on our hands, which was a very, very sad business. That one incident on top of the others led to the Mingy report. It led to the really premature death of Gus Miles. It just killed him. That plus another difficulty that he had.
Well,
grounding, yes. Perhaps more serious. But, I was severely criticized on that one for not having close enough relationships with the lower deck. Well, I didn't really feel that was all that justified because every week, at least once a week, I had the heads of departments and used to have the heads of the messes, of the leading seamen of the messes and senior POs in the messes to discuss things. There was another group we were supposed to have had, an elected group from the ship's company was supposed to form a little group on this sort of thing. Well, Maggie had commissioned at a time when that was coming out. We never actually had that on our books. I was vaguely aware of it, but I was trying to use the good old divisional system and have officers do their stuff and look after the sailors in that way. Apparently, as far as this air group was concerned, this wasn't good enough, and we had this incident. So, I'll take my bumps on that. You can't go right through a service career without having somebody criticize you, of course. But I never did feel, Hal, that this was an officer against the lower deck. It was not that. I never did feel that it was because we felt we were Brits. I thought that was a ruddy lot of nonsense. We had the best training the Brits could possibly give us, and we came back and did it in our own way. And the methods that we had of dealing with it were, obviously they seemed to be in difficulty because we were having these incidents. And some of them were caused, let's face it, by the personality of the individuals concerned. I find it hard to accept that the airman aboard Maggie created this incident because they didn't like the executive officer.
No, that's obviously not true. What year was that? I didn't
1948.
Well, look, 1948, I know those those flyboys. I served in her later. They were an irresponsible bunch of buggers that were still figuring themselves as Battle of Britain pilots. I know of one pilot, and I'll put it on tape because it's been on tape before. I was horrified when I went to Maggie that the bar was open at sea in my time here, and it just didn't seem right to me. And I saw with a rather macabre fascination pilots in the wardroom before flying having drinks. Now, I don't mean getting drunk. That seemed incredible to me, but I heard Crash Peaver the night before he flew off, the night before flying, say, I can get my kite airborne before I reach the island. And the next morning I had the watch, and I said, the second officer, what, the gunner, you take her. I went over, and Crash flew by the island. He had done it. Then he went into a torque stall and killed himself. Now, I only tell that story to show that the flyboys in those years were not the well-disciplined flyboys that Jim Hunter was later. Jim was an excellent flyer. He went to bed at 9 o'clock when he was flying.
Yeah.
So you did have that kind of a flyboy to deal with. And your background and training was not along the scarf around the neck, top button undone lines, Debbie.
Mm. Well, I was aware that flyboys that did come aboard, both the officers and the men, didn't entirely like the routine that we had on board. I must say, as executive officer and president of the wardroom mess, I required people to be decently dressed when they came in for their dinner at night, and that wasn't all too popular with a lot of them, but that's water under the bridge. Yeah. But I don't think you can really pin this on the fact that we all wanted to be Brits.
First,
we have deepest respect for them.
We've stood over into something else. We're not trying to pin anything on anybody. Yeah. We're just trying to understand.
Yeah, sure.
All we seek is understanding. Now, my point was that there were a heck of a lot of RCNVR officers, terribly untrained in 46, 47. Some of them didn't get their joke course till 50. What was the feeling of Mickey Sterling said, I suppose, it's still running, give a loud click when we're finished. Mickey Sterling said, I suppose I did feel slightly resentful to these RCNVR lieutenants because I had worked very hard to get my two stripes starting as a cadet, and they came in with two. He said, I suppose I did, Hal. Did you feel anything like that?
Never, ever did. But, of course, I was so darn young. I felt like one of the young, inexperienced ones myself, although I had had a lot more training. And in retrospect, I suppose I have to look back when I read the various books, etc., that have been written and stories about myself when I was involved in some of these things, good, bad, and indifferent, that I was considered in some awe because I had straight stripes on. But I never, ever felt that right from the beginning of the early war days aboard Restigouche. We had more than 50% of volunteer reserve officers on board, and they were damn good fellows and good friends have been to this day.
Well, they soon became first lieutenants. Johnny Coghlan was Jimmy Hibbert's first lieutenant in Haida, and then they became COs. Gus Bolton got a destroyer, and so on. It's my private opinion, which is not much use historically, but might prompt something from you, that the RCNRs initially were much better than the RCNVRs because at least they could take the ship out to where it was supposed to go and bring it back, and we couldn't even do that. But later on, I think the RCNVR officers were better than a lot of the merchant marine officers.
So to put that in perspective, the Rockies, as we call them, the RCNRs, they had the seaman's experience, but they had very little of the experience of dealing with the men and dealing with the weapons, etc.
You've heard of Skinner's way of dealing with defaulters, have you? Skinner and Arrowhead?
Probably.
It's on another tape. He didn't think he should have defaulters. He didn't think anybody should do things like that in his ship, so if they were drunk, he threw them in the chain locker and kept them there a couple of days. No interview, no officer of the lot. And if they did come in front of him, he'd say, do you think you can take me? And the big birdie Sturber said, yeah, Captain, I think I can take you, and they'd fight it out. And Skinner always won. Now, that's not quite what you were taught in your RN cruisers, but anyway. That's the difference between the three navies we had, and it's really quite extraordinary that within 3 years we were working well together.
Yeah. But I can most honestly say that never in the course of the war did I ever feel that a VR officer in my ship was anything else but one of the band of brothers that made the ship work. Never had to make an allowance for the fact that, gosh, this guy is a volunteer reserve, we have to make allowances for him. We had good fellows from the volunteer reserve, and we admired them enormously, and they did, of course, a super job for the Navy as a whole.
Those are the four main things that I had to talk about. Let's just sit and contemplate for a moment and see what else there is.
Well, in retrospect, we look back. We've just had a tremendously nostalgic week here in Halifax. We're now talking on the 29th of June. We've just had the annual gathering of the Naval Officers Association in Halifax, the most wonderful outpouring of love and affection for the Navy, exercised by those, most of them, who were wartime officers and ratings as well. And to me, it's just been one of the most wonderful experiences I have ever had of being in with a group of 800 old shipmates. Perhaps I would have known 100 of them, but the other 700 knew quite a lot about me because, after all, I've been in the Navy for 35 years and had a lot of interesting jobs. And meet old shipmates who remember when, Debbie, old buddy, when you weighed me off to this, that, or we did this, that, or the other thing, or the hilarious incidents that they remember. It was a wonderful weekend, and we, although it poured with rain and poor old slackers and the fog came down and the drizzle was always with us, the events that we had, like the lobster party at Scotian with our wives, and then the next day the dinner and the ball, and yesterday the marvelous fleet review, it just sort of put everything into perspective. Our finest hour back with our old shipmates on show. Of course, on occasions like that, everybody forgets the difficult moments they had. They remember only the fun and the happy times, and that's what we were exchanging. The result of the whole thing left one with a very happy feeling that if we did have our little difficulties here and there with the few people who caused trouble in our service, be they officers or ratings, it was all an experience that we would all gladly live again, and we consider to be the finest hour that we have had. I'm just so thrilled with...
I've been choked up pretty well all this week.
That's right.
I have.
And let's face it, the Naval Officers Association is almost entirely made up of volunteer reserve officers. Mm-hmm. And the few of us who are the Flaming Straight Stripers are held with a certain amount of respect, which is very nice because of our age and experience and sometimes our rank. But I was just overjoyed the tremendous effort put in on behalf of the volunteer types who really keep this Naval Officers Association going, and very heartwarming and good for us as human beings, good for us as Canadians. Well, can only have a wonderful effect in the future.
I'm going to tell you a story about the man that I knew the longest that I met here. And when I'm telling that, which will break your heart, it's still breaking mine, I want you to tell me about the man you met that you have known the longest this week. But at the first night, when we just had this gathering, it was the come and meet party, I think they called it, meet and greet party. We all just walked down, we were just having drinks. And that was the night nobody had shut up to listen to Admiral Wood. He must have thought, gosh, we're insubordinate bunch of bastards like this, how did we ever win the war? I don't know what he thought. I'll ask him. But anyway, I was walking around there, and there was an older man, and well, my age, outside the door with a woman, obviously his wife, and he beckoned me to come to the door. And I went out, and he said, "Are you Sub-Lieutenant Lawrence, sir?" And so I thought, well, this goes back a way. So I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Well, I'm leading Seaman Berry, and I was with you and Captain Grubb in Moose Jaw." And I said, Berry, yes, of course, Fred Berry. And I haven't got a memory like you, but that came up. And he said, well, he was so pleased to see me. His eyes misted. And he said, you see, nudging his wife, he said, I told you. He said, I said to her, they're all going to be at the Nova Scotian tonight. Why don't we go down and see if Sub-Lieutenant Lawrence is there? So I said, well, come in. He said, I'm not an officer. I said, come in. And I took him over and gave him a drink and talked to him for a while. And I said, now, I've got to move off for a while, but if you need another drink, buy a ticket. Nobody will know you're not an officer if that's bothering you. I said, as a matter of fact, they're behaving a lot worse, some of them, than you are. And I'll see you. And I met him again this morning at breakfast, and we got talking again, and we're going to do a tape like this. And this morning I said, where'd you lose that finger? He said, in Moose Jaw. I said, yeah, a depth charge fund. He said, yeah, that's right. I said, that's a nice bit of surgery. He said, yeah, that's right. I said, you remember who took it off? He said, Jesus, it was you. I said, yes. I said, it was smashed flat. We had no SBA. We had no doctor. I said, but the navigator had a straight razor, and we put you in the water, and we gave you a tumbler full of rum. You weren't feeling anything. It was still numb.